You're listening to Ride Along, EMT School. I'm Mike.
And I'm Max. We're two students navigating EMT school, bringing you along week by week.
And I'm Jonathan, paramedic, bringing real-world perspective.
Join us as we share the lessons, challenges, and stories from EMT school, and hear insights from those already living the EMS life. Welcome to the Ride Along. Yeah, that music gets me psyched up every time. Every time.
He's ready to go.
Episode 3.
So good.
Welcome.
Welcome, everybody, to the Ride Along, Episode 3. What are we naming this one?
It is Moral Quandaries and Hip-Throwing Patients.
Moral Quandaries and Hip-Throwing Patients. That's what we learned in this class was, how to really do some deep introspective on the morality of
hip-throwing
emergency
patients.
Services and how to move patients with our bodies. You know, you learn some cool shit in the EMS world. And this week we actually, the nice thing is we got a nice mix in this class.
We did.
Because it was, hey, here's some headier topics, things that you can kind of, chew on for a bit, things that you could talk about, discuss. And then, okay, now we're actually going to drag each other and lift each other and move each other around the room.
I'm so glad they didn't do it the other way around.
Yeah.
Because if they expected anyone to sit in the chair and, like, then go through a lecture about ethics and legalities after moving people around, that would have went really, really poorly.
Yes. Well, it might be a way to, introduce yourself to somebody easier, Nothing is more funny than watching a student body of 20-year-olds like, okay, guys, you need to start like lifting and rolling each other. And everyone's like they're touching each other with like fingertips and roll him into a recovery position. And they're like,
yeah,
is it okay if I'm like, yes, you need to make sure it's okay. But you should really get into this like you're doing it, because you're not going to do that when it's like time to move a patient. Like,
I had nothing but firefighters. There was no give a damn.
Oh, really?
Just like, and at one point we were doing log roll and I had grabbed a hold of the guy's belt, and the instructor was like, oh, that's a really good idea. And I'm like, yeah, there's a big giant thing, black thing right here that's solid that I can grab a hold of and move them around with.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Again, I didn't go there.
I didn't say it.
You didn't say it.
I saw Jonathan's face, though.
Yes.
So like, little tips along the way, like how to move people, like, hey, some of that BJJ and other combatives classes are paying off, like,
sure.
Hip throws, one of the things we learned was like how to move a patient by yourself. Like, what are ways that you could emergency carry or urgent carry or whatever. We'll get into that in a minute. Fun physical stuff that we started getting into for this class of like practical skills
and some important ethics and legal side of things that'll keep, again, protect you as a provider.
Right. But with that said, we can get into our first regular scheduled programming, segment. Thank you, man. It's been a long day. Our regular segment of the medical term of the week. And the medical term for this week is very closely related to ethics and legal and morality type stuff.
Yeah.
There is a term that we learned this week that was used a lot. One that you probably don't hear too much, throughout normal walks of life. But it's one that, was very central, and this is the term implied consent.
Yep.
And it's used a lot in terms of, what does an EMT, I'm not even going to necessarily put it into the EMT world.
No.
Because it applies to everything. It's essentially, if you were to help somebody and provide them care, whether as a typical standard, Joe Schmo walking through the street, or a paramedic or a doctor or whatever. The idea is that if somebody cannot consent for themselves, and a normal person would look at them and go, they would want care. You are legally, ethically, morally allowed to provide care for them.
Right.
Without necessarily being, you know, considered to be doing it without their consent. It's implied because they can't. How, like, practically, how does this come into play? Well, it's really the most often in cases of unconsciousness. So, like, if you were, say you are an EMT and you are rolling up on an accident scene and somebody is unconscious, they cannot tell you, I do not want care. They cannot refuse care because they are not conscious. So you are in the clear to help them, to provide care. Otherwise, if you came upon the scene and they said, I am refusing care, and you help them anyway, that's assault.
Yes.
Touching somebody without their consent is assault. So it's essentially the thing saying, you know, the benefit of the doubt really goes to, like, helping somebody under a reasonable circumstance, right? Would that, would you say that's a pretty good summation, Jonathan?
Yeah, that's a fair way to articulate it. We always go back to sort of the legal terms of what would a reasonable person want done if they were unconscious and having some sort of life-threatening emergency. They would want care to be provided to them. So yeah, that 100% hits it on the head, Mike.
So some of the rules we learned in terms of, like, providing care and the idea of consent is that there's also express consent. That's what you get from, what you need to get from somebody if they can provide consent, right? They have to expressly say, yes, I would like you to help me.
Yeah.
Maybe not so articulately, but if you go, like, essentially you need to be asking if they have the capability to answer for themselves. Hey, my name's Mike. Can I help you? Like, you look injured. Can I assist? Like, basically giving them the idea that you are going to start helping them, and they have to essentially go, no, I do not want you to help me. And then if they do that, there is a whole rigorous process that you as a healthcare as a provider should be doing to make sure that that is super expressly stated, to make sure that it is not misconstrued that you are not providing care, because then that gets into a whole nother aspect of ethics in terms of neglect, where, you know, you can be considered to be not providing care that you should be.
Right.
Or
negligent or whatever. Yeah.
It's not often that people, like, refuse care, but it's their right as a human being to say, no, I don't want your help. And it happens probably more often than, like, never. So, and especially if people are, like, you know, if they're in trouble with the law, I'm sure they probably are less inclined to go into some sort of health system or whatever. We could go into all the reasons as to why somebody would want to refuse care. But essentially, if they do, like, as somebody who is morally, ethically obligated to provide the care, you need to be making sure that everybody knows this guy just said, no, I don't want it. Documenting it, videoing it if you can, doing all the things to make sure that your ass is covered. Now, implied consent is also, you know, it comes into play with people who are not just unconscious. It's also minors and people who cannot make decisions for themselves. And that can be a bunch of different things. It can be those that are mentally incapacitated, drunk, under the influence of drugs, somebody who is mentally deficient, like all the different things of somebody who normally has to have somebody else make, you know, legal or decisions for them as a caregiver. They cannot refuse care, essentially. Their caregiver can. So a parent can refuse for a child, but a child cannot refuse emergency care. Now, if you come across it, there's other types of consent in there too, because consent took us almost an hour just talking about the idea of consent, right? Which it should, because it's important. It's probably the basis of what we will be doing.
It's where it starts. Like,
you have to start there. But I found it super interesting that minors actually fall into the category of essentially they can never consent for themselves.
That's anyone under the age of 18.
Under the age of 18. And there's some stipulations that if there's an emancipated minor, right, or the one I found interesting was like if they're 17 but are enlisted in the military, yep, they can actually refuse their own medical care. But like essentially it's like children can't consent for themselves. So yeah, like how does this play into things? Well, it's really just meant to be like the catch-all of like, it's about refusal, mm-hmm, right? My takeaway from the week was, you know, as somebody who's going to be tasked with going out and helping people, the default, the reasonable expectation is that you will provide care, unless there's very specific circumstances that you have to know and be aware of where you shouldn't. And those are when somebody expressly says, hey, I am refusing care, or I am refusing care for this minor that is in my charge, or like for this other person that I am the legal guardian of. Right.
Yeah.
That's really the kind of the overview of it, but, it doesn't apply at all really if somebody is alert, oriented, competent, they have to give expressed consent.
Right.
And those are the kind of big distinctions. Mm-hmm. And then like, there's a bunch of nuances kind of around there, but, that was I had heard the term before of implied consent. I found it probably the most interesting part of our class the other night where it was like, okay, there's a lot of, interplay between the moral, the ethical and the legal in this particular concept, because, and this is me just looking at it from a normal, like, you know, a 40-year-old guy who values personal liberty of if somebody says, hey, I'm refusing care, and they look me in the eye, they're competent, whatever, and then they pass out in front of me and they then lose consciousness. Technically,
that is implied consent.
They lose consciousness. They no longer have the ability to deny care,
yep,
because they are unconscious. And then I am obligated as an EMT to provide care for them, yep, even though they expressly just told me,
yep,
that they do not want it.
Yep.
And that was an interesting kind. That's a moral quandary for me, because that guy just denied it. And yep, even though he's unconscious, he no longer can deny it.
But you still ultimately want to try and respect his rights. I think the interesting part about it is not only does it set the basis of the entire thing, but it also is giving you that first peek into who the patient is, what's going on with the patient. Are they alert? Are they compromised? Do they have their faculties about them? Like it literally is setting the stage for everything else you're doing up to, including figuring out what's going on with the patient. It was a very interesting conversation.
Oh, and before I forget, I did miss one major note about implied consent. It has to be life-threatening.
Yeah.
Like, unconsciousness is considered life-threatening. Like, that is the only time where implied consent really comes into play. Otherwise, it's express. You have to get express consent. So, that's my medical term of the week.
It's a good one.
Yeah. I'm sure
it's important stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll chat about it more throughout some of this other stuff, too. But
yeah.
Have you, on the job, Jonathan, have you like come across people who have expressly denied care, like in situations where they're like,
yeah,
are you sure?
Yeah. Weekly. Matter of fact, today.
Really?
Yeah. I answered a call today for a gentleman that was involved in a motor vehicle crash. A low speed crash. Long story short, he got down into a ditch and, he still had some momentum behind his vehicle and it rotated. And his vehicle was on its driver's side, more or less. And older guy, nice fella. He was awake, alert, oriented. He could tell us everything that happened, but he does take a blood thinner. And so in my mind, I need to advocate for him and advocate to him that it's probably a good idea to go get checked out. And he was vehement that he did not want to get checked out, that he was fine. And it was my obligation to explain the risk of him not being assessed. So I did that and then had him sign a patient refusal per our protocols. And then we released him, you know, but he was awake, alert, and oriented. He could answer all my questions appropriately. But on the weekly, we deal with patient refusals. And sometimes it's this. Sometimes somebody that is not the patient calls 911.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sometimes people will be bystanders and they'll just see something and they'll call because they think that this person needs help. And then you'll talk to them and it wasn't the situation that it appeared from the outside.
Right.
But in a lot of those instances, we will still get a patient refusal just as a means to cover our butts legally.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's no question as to whether, hey, was this person indeed a patient? Did they need medical care provided to them? Did you advocate for them?
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, it's a very common thing. And so understanding when and how you can utilize consent, whether it be implied consent or expressly given consent to provide care is super, super important.
Yeah. No, that's and I think this is a great example of me kind of, you know, putting my foot in my mouth. Cause I think I maybe even said in that opening thing of like, well, it's probably not very often, but it's one of those things I'm sure is going to be, I'm going to be rudely awakened as to like my assumption of, I bet you most people don't, it's not going to be very often that someone's like, no, don't help me. And I forget that, like, you know, that's totally an assumption on my part in terms of what the role will be like. Cause like, I just assume like if I need help, I'm like, yes, please come to me with the gurney thing and the bag that has the asterisk on the side and has the bandages and the things, like, please. Yes. Bring all of that to me. Cause I need it. Like, I know I just stubbed my toe,
yeah,
but like, you know, please, yes, whatever services you have, please bring them to me.
Well, like the one instructor was saying, like he was saying the most common reason for refusal is no health insurance, mm-hmm, and not wanting, yeah, to incur a however many thousand dollar debt on something that they don't see as critical.
Right.
And I mean, my guess is that most of the time it's not the victim that's calling 911 because, well, they're usually the victim. So you probably have way more bystanders making the phone calls than the person that's actually been experiencing,
yeah,
whatever it is.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a concern. We're talking kind of in a trauma skew, but like sometimes medically, it's a thing of a family member calls and they're right there in the house with them. And they think that, you know, their wife of 25 years needs to go to the hospital because she's been sick but she's fine and she doesn't want to go. And maybe she does have something going on. And maybe at some point it could lead down the path. And that really was where it comes down to. You do a good assessment and you try to educate the person on the risk of not being,
right,
evaluated further. I take people to the hospital, man. That's what I do. I just like, hey,
it's kind of your job.
But what I mean by that is like, I truly advocate people for going and getting checked out.
Yeah.
That, you know, there are some providers and it's one of the things about the job that is mentally taxing, due to a lot of political things and legal things, our healthcare system in aspects has shrank,
mm-hmm,
while patient needs have only grown.
Right. Yeah.
And so 911 fills and ERs fill a lot of that gap that has been created or a lot of that vacuum that's been created. And so oftentimes we're called to take people to the hospital. It's like, oh, man, like this doesn't feel like an emergency, but I have a skewed view because I work in fire rescue, but right, this person feels like it's an emergency. How that plays into, refusals is just that. Oftentimes family members will call or somebody will call. And if you can't take them to the place that they want to go because of, your policies, that they won't go with you.
Mm,
right. They'll choose not to go. Right. I deal with that sometimes with people who want to go to the VA hospitals. Unfortunately, it's an hour away and I can't take my ambulance out of service for an hour,
mm-hmm,
actually more than an hour,
because it's a two hour round trip. Yeah.
Yeah. two and a half hours just to take them there. And so sometimes they will refuse because of that. There's a myriad of reasons people might refuse care.
Yeah.
But it's not just that, hey, I've got my arm locked off. No, I don't want help.
Yeah, yeah. It's I'm pretty sure they're, person. Yeah.
It's just a flesh wound.
Usually not
just,
that guy.
It's just a flesh wound.
What's a flesh wound? I've had much worse than this. No, you haven't.
But yeah, I think that that kind of leads us into the big themes for this class was like moral and ethical dilemmas, right? Yes. Like that for me falls into a moral and ethical dilemma of like,
yeah,
it's not even real. Is it a dilemma? Like, you know, somebody refusing care, I can get behind that. Express care, like, you know, expressly stating what you want, that is less of a dilemma for me. Mm-hmm. But when you throw in the legal side of it, then it becomes because like there was a lot of discussions about what EMTs and even like trained citizens are legally obligated to mm-hmm. do, like mm-hmm. a duty to act, right? Yes. When do you have a duty to act? If someone is hurt, are you obligated? Like because my moral code tends to probably have a higher standard than the legal code. For me, it doesn't really, like, I would probably wind up being aligned with that most times. But in that instance where I'm like, oh, well, that guy, that I do not want to help that guy. I don't know what that situation is, but I would feel, I would definitely see a conflict if, like, the legal side is like, you have to help that guy, and my moral side says, no, he doesn't deserve it. Like, I don't know what situation would cause that, but that could happen.
I think it depends on what hat you're wearing at the time. We were explaining that basically we're always wearing the hat of the EMT. Like whether you're on duty, off duty, you're always wearing that hat. But at the same time, there is a difference between being under obligation because you have the uniform on and what obligation you have morally or ethically when you are, you know, just a civilian on the road.
Right. Or like, okay, a duty to act. And I think this is the one that always pops in my head of like, okay, I'm in a situation. I like one of the things that popped up was in New Jersey specifically, apparently there's a law that if you're an EMT and you're caught not providing care and like leaving the scene of an accident or you know, being witnessed not providing care and somebody knows you, it's like it's such a small thing that it's like impossible to prove, but they could hold you responsible legally for not providing care.
Yep.
And I'm like, but there are situations many a time when I'm like alone with my daughter and there is, I, you know, as much as I want to help everyone, I am responsible for her safety and my own safety. Like 100%. If I provide care, there may be situations where I am putting my daughter at risk, and I mean, that's not okay to me.
How many times do you see these videos of these crashes that start out as one person on the side of the road, and next thing you know, there's three other cars that come along 10 minutes later, smashing into whatever vehicle was sitting on the side of the road that either were stopped for that person or wound up, you know, responding. Like, I'm sorry, like, I am not, I mean, putting myself in jeopardy is one thing. Putting my family in jeopardy? No.
Now, I don't think that's why these laws, like, exist. Like, I think they're meant more for, like, holding people responsible for, like, flagrant or like, you know, negligent care. But law is, like, it's black and white, right? Like, it doesn't take context into account. That's why it has to be interpreted and tried. So...
And that's where your moral and ethics come in.
And then you have to apply the morals and ethics to it. Yep. So, like, I think that was probably one of the things that, like, popped into my head the most of, like, you know, there are often conflicts between those things. But, yeah, so there was a lot of discussion about that this week.
You know, being able to articulate the why you didn't do something is just as important as it is to be able to articulate why you did do something.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and to your example of, you know, you've got your daughter in the vehicle. You know, I have a niece and a nephew that are fairly young. And, you know, at that point, I'm a paramedic, but I am their bodyguard.
Right. Right.
I am taking care of them. And it's,
you're their local parent. Like you are their, Yeah.
To that point of, you know, who's the most important person on the scene? Well, I am, and then my partner, and then the patient, and then the general public. Well, in that instance, those children are my, they're the most important people besides myself that I take care of, and maybe even more important than me in that instance. But yeah, it does, you know, some states have laws like that. I didn't realize New Jersey did. Virginia doesn't really have anything exactly like that, but I was going through the show notes earlier and seeing things, people will put decals on their car.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. And it is, you know, during a mass casualty incident, it in Virginia, a law enforcement officer can, you know, request you to get out of your vehicle and assist them. Now, maybe you have that moral obligation to get out and to provide care, whether you're on duty or not. Well, if you're on duty, you have that actual duty to act.
Right, right.
But if you're off, there is no such duty generally. Mm-hmm. So maybe you feel that moral obligation to help, but it's circumstantial, right? Got your daughter in the car, not going to do it.
Yeah.
Generally.
Yeah. And like, you know, those are the things where it's like, you know, there's so many nuances and additional factors that have to be considered in there, and especially your own safety. And like, mm-hmm. that's why I was like, I can't believe there's laws that exist that actually expressly say that, like, you have to act.
I can.
But I, you know, there's laws for everything.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And speaking of like laws and guides mm-hmm. and things written in stone, you know, along with the moral, legal, ethical side, which, you know, encompasses all types of things like the consent we talked about, the like things like DNRs, do not resuscitate orders, which also kind of applies into consent. And there's nuances to that as well as to like when you can stop providing care. But usually it's like very much in line with like what your medical director says sure. and how they are. Like a lot of times you'll have to call for like, hey, I need a clarification, or like you need to make a decision on whether or not I can or cannot prevent care when it's a situation that's like kind of over the head of whoever's on scene. Right.
Sure.
But then there's things that you have standards and guidelines of that you are, it doesn't necessarily fall into obligations of things, but things that you have to adhere to as part of your practice, right? As part of being an EMT, that was kind of the other side of the, like, okay, there's things that dictate when you can and cannot provide care. And then when you can provide care, here is like the entire list of things that you are allowed to do. And here's a list of things that you are not allowed to do, but maybe an AEMT is, or here's a list of the paramedic care that you can do, or what a paramedic is allowed to do. And then it has, you know, stipulations in it. Like if it's this type of patient, you can provide this on your own. And if it's this situation, then you have to call for permission to do it. And I believe, that is the standard of care, right? Like the terminology for it.
So yeah, I mean, you have a scope of practice.
Scope of practice.
You have a scope of practice based upon your certification level. And so guidelines maybe is the terminology that was used in class. Here we refer to them as protocols.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just to kind of touch on that, there is a national scope of practice for each provider level that is set forth by the National Registry as a general guideline, but it's going to be so specific to your locality that what your medical director is gonna let you do, and your medical director is the doctor whose license you practice under, because we're not just out here doing this, you know, by ourselves. We have physicians who are allowing us to practice under their license,
Yeah.
And give us permission.
We got to episode 3. I'm actually surprised that we haven't mentioned the idea of a medical director yet.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's an essential aspect of like all EMS in the mm-hmm. sense that like every medical thing that you provide,
right.
you're not doing because you are imbued with knowledge and like a certification for it. You're doing it basically mm-hmm. to learn, or like you're getting a certification so that the physician, the actual scientist, the doctor that's in charge of that area, that service, whatever, knows that you went through a certain amount of training so he can trust you or she can trust you with mm-hmm. knowing if A happens, you're allowed to do B,
yeah.
right? Like yeah. that you're to work within this scope of practice.
And also like their medical license is in jeopardy if you F up, because yep. ultimately do you answer that? Yes, but so do they.
Yeah.
So like their medical license is in jeopardy if you do something that you weren't supposed to do.
Or improperly yeah. trained or to do
improperly
it.
Improperly trained to do yeah. it. Yeah.
So just a little tidbit I'm gonna throw out here. That I found interesting when I learned it. Paramedic, the para means alongside, and the medic means the medic is the physician. In the ancient terminology, even though we throw medic around a whole lot, the medic is the physician, the doctor, and para alongside the doctor. Mm. So very much the term paramedic is exactly what we're talking about when we talk about scope of practice and having a medical director and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I just thought that was neat and played into our conversation.
Yeah.
So just a little trivia for you.
Yeah. And I think the other interesting thing too, and you had mentioned this before, there's different levels of scope mm-hmm. of practice, right? There's a national scope of practice. There's probably a state scope of practice.
Yep.
And then at any given time, you might have a like other levels of scope of practice, right? So like, and I think they had mentioned that like most services, like if most EMTs or EMS providers mm-hmm. are going to be under at least 3 medical directors at any one time, and it could be more if their service, like their
yeah.
there's like a service medical director usually, like the local yep. service, a county medical director, I guess. I don't know the exact levels, but then there's usually a state medical director as well.
So it is, yeah, it's gonna differ by locality.
Mm-hmm.
In Virginia, your service or your agency actually may have more than one medical director. I've
right.
worked at agencies that had 2 medical directors. And we were beholden to both of them.
Sure.
And then the way that Virginia is currently broken up, we have EMS regions. So it's not just necessarily county. It's like there's a group of counties geographically located close to one another that yep. has its own body of medical directors. And so they kind of have a default medical director for that region.
Right.
And then there is that state scope of practice.
Yeah.
That we fall under as well. So,
but the tricky part is what you're allowed to do, mm-hmm. at any given situation could be different, based off a direction from one of those medical, like basically you have to default to like whatever the most restrictive mm-hmm. like method is. Right. So like or whoever your immediate medical director, I guess, how does that work if there's a conflict?
It's going to be the most immediate, because you're probably going to, when we get into regional or state level medical directors, usually that scope is what the state allows it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then your local medical director could be more restrictive, and right. oftentimes they are.
Yeah, like in Pennsylvania, or say any random state, as an EMT, yeah. my rough understanding is like you usually have the ability to administer oral glucose, right, for yeah. diabetic emergencies. With
yeah.
you may work for a service that has a medical director that's like, nope, you're not allowed to provide that without calling me first,
yeah.
or something along yeah. those lines.
That would be goofy, but yes, that is actually a good example.
Well, it's the first thing that popped in my head, because I still don't know. I don't know. I know hardly anything as to what the scope of practice is for an EMT yet. I just know that like oral glucose is one of those.
Well, one of the things they did yeah. say was that it seemed like when in doubt, call it in. Like if you're not sure, instead of trying, yeah. instead of, you know, doing something maybe shouldn't, you have the option, give them a call. And it sounds like that's that going to that default isn't going to shame you. It's accepted that, okay, you're unsure, you're calling, you're asking the question, that way you can get proper instruction.
Yeah. And we had talked at one point, very briefly, I'll say this. There was a time in which we had a particular drug that we could have given a few months before, and then they changed the region, changed the drug that they wanted us to use. And I thought it would be more beneficial for the person to have the drug we used previously. So I had to call in that instance and get medical direction to deviate from my protocol.
Right.
And the doctor gave me permission. And so I went ahead and gave that drug that I was able to give just a few months prior.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
That was effective. So yeah, there are instances where it is going to be more beneficial for you to call and get clarification and some guidance.
Yeah. And like, I think this is going to be the hardest part for me in terms of learning what is and is not, like, essentially memorizing the sheet. Like we got a sheet in class, mm-hmm. of like these, mm-hmm. the Pennsylvania EMT scope of practice.
Right.
And I start scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. And I'm like, okay, this is a lot of stuff, and I'm sure it'll get easier over time. But I would not be true to myself if I did not mention the fact that I feel like I would probably be in an ethical dilemma, mm-hmm. if I lived by that sheet to say, like, that's all I can ever do. You know what I mean? Like, so for, like, I know this, yes. gets into a gray area, so I will not advocate for deviating from that, especially in terms of an EMT course and like, you know, the properness of going through EMT school. But I think it wouldn't be true to myself and like the, you know, what people go through in terms of, well, what if I can provide more? Like, what if I can do more? Like somebody who is, say, an 18 Delta medic in Special Forces, they have, mm-hmm. such a huge scope of practice, right? Like they are essentially like field surgeons. And you know, they come back to the States and they are presented with, say, a MASH casualty incident. Well, you know, maybe they're working as an EMT. I highly doubt that person is going to just limit themselves to just being like, well, I'm only working as an EMT right now, so I can only provide basic medical care, instead of providing my full ethical ability. So like, I'm just recognizing that, like, there is that quandary. But also, caveat, I fully intend to,
sure.
just stick within my scope of practice for being an EMT. Not that I really know much beyond that anyway, you know, but I could see that happening.
So there are times where you will attend a training that is an extracurricular outside of your base level of EMT training, or even as an EMT, you'll attend and you will get to participate and do some skills. We do this all the time when we teach tactical medical courses. We show the EMTs and let them participate in some of the ALS type skills.
Mm-hmm.
And we give them the caveat, look, this is not us authorizing you to do anything. Only your medical director can do that. And then there's still limitations within that yep. sort of thing. But we do it as a means to educate them on the procedure.
Right.
That being said, I did a lot of that extracurricular activity training wise, and it was frustrating at times as an EMT to be in a position where it's like, man, I do know that I could do more, but I also understood that my certification and my ability to practice and my financial well-being were on the line if I ever deviated from what my protocol said I could do.
It's almost like going through EMT school, I'm actually becoming more limited in what I'm allowed to do if I come across certain stuff, because, like, for instance, as a normal everyday citizen, I've learned how to do things with, like, you know, a chest decomp needle, like a tension pneumothorax, like some trauma training. Now, I'm not saying I would ever use those, but it's good to know how to do that. But the idea is like, okay, so now if I'm going out into the world as an EMT, that I certainly cannot do legally. Like, no longer, like, and I'm sure there, you legally can't do that in certain circumstances either way, but it's just like, these are the things you have to be aware of. You have to think about, I would say, think about them before you get out into the world and have to like make decisions on the fly, because these are things that like, you know, you should know getting into this, that you, you have to subscribe and adhere to the scope of practice.
And I mean, make the decision about whether or not you can live with that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you know you can't, and you find that you can't, then, you know, maybe the training's been valuable, but maybe the job isn't for you.
Well, and that's the thing. That's one of the aspects of the job, that is frustrating at times, right? Knowing that there's maybe more that could be done, but because like, it's even more frustrating when you are at a particular certification level and the state scope of practice is one way, and then your local protocol says that you're limited on doing this activity. That's the real frustrating
thing. I could only imagine, and I'm sure those will come into play.
They do. And but at the end of the day, I have to, my medical director is the one that allows me to practice. So I have to make sure that they're happy, whether they're right, wrong, or indifferent. It's their license.
Right.
And so when we're talking about the moral obligation of it, we have to understand that our hands are kind of tied.
Yes.
In that, if we, because let's say you do something out of your scope of practice that your medical director doesn't allow you to do, but it's totally within your level's scope of practice. You get your certification stripped from you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How much good are you to your community at that point?
Yeah. Right.
So it's a balancing act.
Yeah, for sure.
And I was talking about this at work today. If you're going to be a cowboy and do cowboy stuff, you better be a cowboy and you better be right about it.
Yeah.
But that's not to advocate for folks going outside of those good practices. It's just saying, look, if you're going to call and ask to do some stuff that maybe you ought not be doing, and you're going to ask permission to do it, maybe you need to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like truly know.
Well, and I think this also comes around to the idea that this is not like, it may be a calling for some people, and it may be some like a skill set, but at the end of the day, it's a profession, and you have to treat it professionally, and to treat it the part of the profession is knowing that you have to work within medical guidelines, or protocols. And that's how I kind of, you know, resolve this in myself at the end of the day. Like if I'm working as an EMT, or if I get a role as one, or when I get a role, whatever you want to call it, treating it as like approaching it professionally is adhering to those, to that. And like, there's reasoning behind it that I may not, like, I don't have context to do. I'm not a doctor. I don't know the clinical, data that's probably supporting that decision. So you have to trust that.
Yeah. I mean, that's at the end of the day, if you get your certification taken from you because you do something outside of your scope of practice, you're not a benefit to your, you're not a benefit to your community like you want to be.
Yeah.
So, it's weighing those moral obligations, if you will.
Yeah. So this is why I thought this class was like a lot of fun. It was a lot of PowerPoint, like we talked about in the last episode, a lot of words on screens with bullet points, not a lot of pictures for this upfront, like moral section, but, I still had a lot of fun, 'cause I was like, oh, like we can have discussions on this. And like, it's so funny, 'cause like, you know, there weren't a lot of people talking. It was a lot of me and Max asking questions.
Yes.
I expected that because we've been through more, like we have, like, you know, I'm more inclined to like you know, I want to know what the thought, like, what is the reasoning behind this? What is the rationale, right? It can't, like, sometimes I need a little bit more than just the, all right, they said to do this, right? So,
right.
That's where you get into like the moral ethics stuff. It's like, it's all about the back story. It's mm-hmm. all about the context. So that was the big, like the first section of the class was all that stuff. And there were some other topics in there too. Like Good Samaritan laws, which kind of fall into the consent stuff where it's like, you know, you have protection. If you're just, if you're doing reasonable things as a good person, the law is going to, for the most part, protect you. You know, confidentiality was a big one. We talked about HIPAA. Do you know the acronym? Like it's an acronym, HIPPA, right?
Personal.
I don't know.
Health information.
Personal Protection
something,
Act.
Something. Yeah. Health some, information and.
Personal information I don't know. Act.
I don't know.
Privacy, like it's Privacy Act.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without having it right here in front of me.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No. You're good. You're good.
Everybody just refers to it as HIPAA. And as HIPAA. And it's huge. Like, you know, patient information needs to be protected. Privacy is huge because medical information can be like getting out into the world. It can be super damaging for any person. So
that was
one of the things that was like ethically, morally, legally, you are responsible for medical information that is in your trust.
We all totally butchered that acronym, by the way.
Oh, really?
It's HIPAA.
Oh, HIPAA. Oh,
yeah. Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act.
Oh, that was way Samsonite. Way off.
I didn't think insurance was in there anywhere.
Well, you know, it's the catch-all act that says that, you know, patient information that is identifiable to them cannot be, like, you know, released, right? We have to prevent, like, you know, patients being identified with their medical care.
Yep.
Or their medical situation, right?
Yeah.
Status. What else did we do? Oh, mandatory reporting. Like, I was like, oh, that's probably a big one that I'm sure EMTs see probably more than...
Far too much, I'm sure.
Most other providers, because they go out into the real world and they are the ones that get called to the incident. So... I imagine that being something that, you know, being a mandatory reporter or seeing something like child abuse or spousal abuse or elderly abuse or, you know, mistreatment of anybody who shouldn't be mistreated, they're going to see it probably before most other people are.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, and I've been pretty fortunate in my career. I have not seen a whole lot of the abuse side of the house. I've seen some, and what I have seen has been pretty bad. But it's not something that I run into on the daily.
Yeah.
Now that being said, you go to some other places, guys are seeing this every single shift, and it's not a good thing. Like we've kind of touched on before, you know, you see people on their worst days, and it's a heavy weight to carry. It's an honor to be able to do that, but it's a heavy weight to carry.
Yeah.
And
the idea that if you see it, like as a mandatory reporter, you don't have the discretion. Not that you'd want to have discretion, and like I would almost in certain circumstances have to report things because then I don't have to make a decision on whether I'm going to report it. And then hopefully the system will make sure that the right decision gets, you know, it gets investigated and fairly figured out, you know.
There's an advantage to some things being black and white.
Yeah.
There really is. There's so much gray in here from the little bit we've learned so far. It is nice to have something that is straight up black and white.
Yeah. It definitely does take some pressure out of it for you. I think the frustrating thing is for me as a provider, And with the abuse, we usually, it's usually dealt with pretty readily.
Mm-hmm.
But when we start talking about neglectful things and conditions of housing and things like that, which, you know, there's people that they may not have the best means, but there's also people who are living in what I would deem as unsafe conditions. And maybe there's kids or there's elderly people in those situations. And as a mandated reporter, you know, I've made those calls and it's fell upon deaf ears to the next call. And it's that's a frustrating thing to deal with.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that not to disparage those services you might have to call, because we all do have to work together. And like I said, in the instances of abuse, when I've called and been like, hey, this is what's going on, usually they're pretty quick to jump in, mm-hmm. At least locally. I'm sure other people have different experiences, but with the abuse, especially surrounding children, they're pretty quick to jump in. But it can be frustrating because, you know, we were talking about the websites in episode one to like sign up to go to EMT school and just have to find out about it, and how they're government. A lot of them are government designed websites and the bloat associated with that.
Oh yeah.
I mean, this is just another aspect of the system that it's overworked and there's a lot of potentially unnecessary steps, and it's got to go through so many people to even get to the right person.
Right.
But it is something we deal with. It's part of the profession. Yeah.
And I'm sure it was, you know, it has to be learned. Like it has to be, you know, kind of spelled out to people in the school itself. Like, this is what you may encounter. You know,
it's better be prepared for it than walk into a blind.
Yeah. Like you're out in the world. You may encounter these things.
I've been in so many hoarding houses over the years. Like, it's one of those things when the first time I was ever in one that was bad, like, they tried explaining to me, they tried like describing to get me, like, I guess, prepared. I was not, like,
sure,
as much as they could, it was still a shock of like, oh my God,
mm-hmm.
like, there is a 95-year-old guy living in this. Where are his kids? Like, why is this man being allowed to live this way?
Right.
You know, so it's one of those things where I think it's the kind of thing where you can only be inoculated to it by experiencing it. But as much as they can prepare the students for it, the better they're going to be able to handle it.
Yeah. So, you know, along with this super fun topic, you know, it is which cheerful. Is totally upbringing
awesome.
And really one of the things that you're getting into EMS for is to like really experience
the smells,
the worst the sides of humanity.
Sights.
Yeah. No. We got to talk and kind of, you know, explore the ethics, the moralities, the legal sides, a bunch of different topics, and like there's a lot to go through. We did in this particular class get to transition into like we totally went from like the heady, like hard stuff to comprehend, like, oh, we have to like contemplate moral dilemmas to okay, so now what we need everyone to do is lay on the ground, pick each other up and move each other around.
Exactly.
Which admittedly was way more uplifting, like physically, like literally than like talking about mandatory reporting. But it was just so funny to have such different aspects of EMT training be on the same night, like something very physical, something very heady, right?
The job has so many aspects,
but that's the job. Like that's
so many aspects to it.
That's why I think it's an alluring profession for people that go out there. Cause it's like, it's not a desk job. I guess you can have a desk job as an EMT, but like, this is the core of it is getting out there.
Whenever you are doing a job where you are physically going into other people's homes, you never know what you're going to get on that particular day.
Life's like a box of chocolates.
It really is.
You never know what you're going
to
get.
I have walked up to homes that looked like they were going to be pristine, and I was shocked. I've walked up to homes that looked like they were going to be trash, and they were pristine. Like, or in any other variable.
Yeah. Yeah. You never know. You never know. It's a variety, which is, I guess, probably a great thing too for people who don't want the same thing every day. But we got to learn how to transport patients, which essentially is probably one of the things that will, I assume, and you could check us on this, Jonathan, going to be doing a lot. Like,
I mean, every single call you go,
every
on,
single one, I
every assume. Single call you go on, the first thing I'm doing as like, if I'm, whether I'm driving or I'm like riding up front or like, even from the point of dispatch, when they give me the address and I, you know, yeah, you should know your first due area, but I always like to look on the GPS and see the satellite image.
Street view is the kinda, shit.
Yeah, kind of judge what's going to be the best avenue of approach. Do I want to use the back door or the front door? Do they have stairs?
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the onset of the call where you're getting dispatch information and the nature of the call is put out, you're just thinking about, or you should be thinking about, how am I going to get this person into the ambulance?
Yeah.
Yep.
Every single call.
And so we didn't even get into necessarily like the scene itself and the route planning and how to get to and from. We like the second half of that class was strictly like, you and this other person are in a room and you need to move them from that thing to that thing. And like, or it's you and a partner in a room and you need to move that person from there to that. Like, it was just the physical, like point A to point B stuff.
We broke it up into four sections. So there was without equipment, moving people around.
Yeah. So carries,
Either single, double, triple. There was learning how to use the different backboards.
There were three. I think they had the traditional like long backboard, which they did mention that is not as prevalent as it used to be. Because like everybody used to get backboarded back in the day, and then they've moved away from that because it aggravates like injuries.
They had the split one.
Yep.
It's the
scoop stretcher.
Scoop stretcher. And then they had that. Is it still? Stilt stretcher?
It was a flexible one. Was it the Reeves?
Reeves
sleeve Reeves stretcher.
Mm-hmm. Which was, somebody looked at me weird when I was like, oh, it's like a litter, but with staves in it. And they go, what? I'm like, a litter. They're like, what's a litter? I'm like, I guess I come from different circles of medical stuff. Cause like, I'm like, it's the same, it's a piece of canvas and it's got some slats in it. And you carry people in it.
Another word for a litter is a soft stretcher.
Soft stretcher. Yeah, exactly.
But you have a pulled litter as well, which would be like, you know, your Talon litter or something like that.
Right.
On the other side of the house where we talk about medical stuff.
Yeah.
But a soft stretcher or mega mover. Mega mover is like a colloquial term. Like people use it like Kleenex.
Yeah.
It refers to a particular product, but it's a soft stretcher.
So a quick shout out to Jonathan and his classes at Iron Forge Consulting Group. I was, and Max were both very familiar with carries. Because that's one of the core concepts and things that we learned to do in that class. That felt very familiar. Oh, okay, well, we're going to do a single man extremity carry. Okay, that one's easy. I do that all the time. Like, you know, grab by the arms, walk backwards, you know. Two-man carry, three-man carry, you know, it's all part of that. So the carries, I think, we're you know, pretty familiar with. Not stretchers, but like the backboards. That was pretty easy. We're going to learn how to basically roll the patient, put the backboard down, and roll them back onto it, or keep them in place and then move the scoop stretcher around them and scoop under them. Like, those are easy ones. The one that I like was like, ooh, I could probably do this for like half a class is like playing with the like professional tools, quote unquote, like the tools that I would never have access to anywhere else of like, and they're very specific. Well, the stretcher wheeled stretcher is very specific to like ambulance use. Right. So like,
yes,
you wouldn't necessarily bring that thing around unless you were running an ambulance. Incredibly or had a light facility.
Right.
But that was my first time touching one of those things. Yeah. And like, oh, it goes up. Like, I have to do it this way to bring it up. And like, oh, it can go into an... I wish we had an ambulance, because I would have loved to see... Because they explained to us, like, this is how it goes into the ambulance. And I go, oh, okay, but how does the legs come up? And the just do this. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't know how to... Like, I can't see what you're doing because we don't have the ambulance. So, like...
I think on December 6th, we're gonna
probably, yeah.
Yeah.
I promise at some point you're going to see how the
strategy works. I'm sure. And I'll be sick of it, but within an hour, but it was one of those things like, I don't know what you're doing. Like, I want to know more. And, so that was interesting. Like, okay, it goes in there and like the legs come up and down. It was a non-motorized, non-assisted stretcher,
but very intuitive. Like shocker. Everything well designed. That's red,
yeah.
Everything that's red does something.
Yeah. So handles were red. If the handles are red, it makes things move.
Happen.
Like had all types of different and super light, way lighter than I thought.
That's
it would be.
That's what I was saying. I was actually shocked because I have handled a wheeled stretcher before, and the one I handled, there's no way I could get that off the ground by myself.
I was expecting it to be like tubular stainless steel.
Yes.
And like, I guess that maybe.
You know, if we look back in like this equipment is always changing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If we look back in history, you will see all sorts of things.
Oh yeah.
Like that.
Like wrought iron, like wheelchairs, like,
or yeah.
Less of that in EMS, but, right, but like, you know, you got to think ambulances used to be hearses. They used to have to like, the gurney to get somebody in the hearse was oftentimes, you know, something that was utilized back in the day. But yeah, stuff like this has changed. It changes pretty frequently. They're always doing updates, and I think it's to sell more products. But sometimes they're definitely quality of life changes.
Yes.
You know, it sounds like you guys were working with some manual stretcher options. Mm-hmm. They have power cots that use like a 18-volt battery, and that will lift the cot all the way up.
Yep.
And then, you know, you put it in the ambulance, it'll lift the legs up. And
crazy.
It'll do all the things for you. Yeah.
It's amazing. Like And honestly, like legitimately good for the EMS. Like, you know, some of those things you might be like, oh, that's a gimmick. But like all of those things lead to less injury because that was the one thing I was like, man, moving patients around, lifting these things up. Like you're doing a lot of lifting and a lot of like awkward, because lifting a body sucks.
Oh, it's
like,
horrible.
They are like when you have dead weight. They're gangly. Mm-hmm. They're hard to move. Like, it's so easy to hurt yourself. And like, the more you can get assistance in that, either with another person or with a some sort of assisted device, like that, you know, it leads to better outcomes for EMTs and for patients because they're less likely to get injured or hurt or, you know, mishandled. So like, those are things I'm like, yes, like you can easily point to like composite materials and like, you know, it's an easy justification for like, let's upgrade this thing because it may cost more, but it's worth
it. It's going to cost less in the end.
And yeah, it may cost us less.
Well, and you know, back injuries are very, very prevalent in public safety for lots of reasons. Some of which is we don't take as good a care of ourselves as we should physically, but a lot of it does relate to the fact that people don't fall perfectly. It's not like when you're in the gym and you have a static load and you know exactly how you're going to lift this, you know exactly the mechanics. Sometimes your body positioning and the way the person's laying does not allow for that perfect inline proper lifting technique to be utilized. It just doesn't.
Yeah.
So you either need more people to help you or you need these devices like we're talking about. You guys are absolutely right. The cost benefit analysis of that is, okay, I have half of my, you know, or I have a bunch of my people out with back injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have to pay all this overtime to get those slots filled. I could have just bought the power cot and called it a day.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I get it. There's always going to be that dichotomy, right? Like, okay, I need to stay within a budget.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
because if I spend too much on the stuff, A, I'm not going to be able to buy other things I might need, or, you know, at a certain point I need to spend money on staffing rather than stuff. And it's like, and ultimately I think one thing that we'll probably wind up talking about a bunch in all of this world is like just how underfunded, or like how like really a lot of these services really deserve more, and the ability to like bring in more people or bring in more stuff. Like,
sure.
But they make do with what they have. Some of them are going to be underfunded. Some will be, you know, properly funded. That's a whole world that I'm like, I'm sure that's probably going to come with time. Like, mm-hmm. I'll have a better understanding of how all that works together. You can already tell, like, you know, some of the guys that are teaching the class or whatever, they're like, yeah, we don't have those. Like, those are
the rich companies.
Dude. Yeah, the rich companies have the what was it, the vacuum beds or something like that.
Yeah, vacuum stretcher.
Vacuum stretchers.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. We don't have
them. Right
now. They're great for certain circumstances, but yeah, sure. We don't have one.
Yeah,
we can't justify it.
Yeah, and like, you know, so there might be really, you know, specific use pieces of equipment that not everybody has. Yeah. But there might be just like, I know how the medical world works. Like I've worked in pharmaceuticals for 20 years. So like, you know, sometimes things are just really expensive because they're novel and somebody owns a patent on it.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with whether or not maybe someday everyone can afford one, but today only the richest can. Which is a sad thing about medicine in general, but hey, I'm digressing here.
You are indeed.
I think
you're right there, Mike.
Yeah. So we learned to move patients. We learned the carries, the drags, actually we didn't do any drags, and there were some interesting ones on those PowerPoints.
That's certainly a word for one of them.
Okay. I have to talk about this one.
You do indeed.
Did they call it a fireman's drag? Are you familiar with a fireman's drag?
I mean, it depends on what you mean.
Okay. I will describe it to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Take the patient and lie them on their back. Take their hands and bind their hands together.
Yes.
And then crawl between their arms so that their arms are around your shoulders. Straddle them and then crawl forward. So that their arms are wrapped around your neck and you're dragging them underneath you as you crawl. And I understand what that would be for. It's like, hey, if there's smoke in the environment and you want to keep the patient low to the ground. Yeah, I get that. But let me tell you, it makes a rather unsettling visual when you see it on a PowerPoint.
That's funny.
Anyway, we've gone through... all of that stuff, the things that we've talked about in the class. However, it brings us as a tool for moving people around to Max's tool of the trade,
and that would be the stair chair.
So we got to use this the class, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the yin to the yang of the stretcher, the wheeled stretcher.
So it's basically a wheeled folding chair, and the patient can be secured into it using straps. The neat thing about it is that on the back side of it, it has this track, thank you, that folds out. And what it allows you to do is it gives you a little bit of resistance so you can move a full-grown male down a set of stairs very evenly without any jarring motions to do potentially hurt the patient. And it allows people to move people downstairs very, very efficiently. Like, it was surprising. I was surprised how well it moved down the stairs, because the guy that we had in the chair was heavier than me.
Mm.
Plus, it has extendable handles top and bottom to get a little more reach involved. I mean, it's kind of akin to what I did for 27 years, which is kind of cool. And I've used one once before because we were actually at or seen one used once before because it was at a customer's house and they were bringing their mother out and they were using one of these things. So it's kind of cool. It's like, oh, I remember that thing. It does have some limitations. It can't be used for an unresponsive patient. Can't be used for a patient that has suspected spinal or neck injury. It also apparently can't be used for patients with respiratory distress, I guess, because of the compression on their chest of the straps or the fact that they need to be laid down flat. And then also, once you get to the bottom of the stairs, it has four wheels and it allows you to move them around.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pretty cool piece of kit, and it folds pretty damn small too.
Yeah, it's. I assume you use an appliance dolly in your like it reminded me of an appliance dolly with a seat on it.
With a seat on it,
like that.
Yeah, it's essential. Like it allows you to roll it downstairs, like you know, lay flat down the stairs at an angle so that it doesn't like boom, boom, boom down each stair.
Yep.
Yeah, I thought it was a really, I'm like, that is a really good example of a tool that has probably evolved over many years throughout the EMS stuff of like, hey, when we first did it, we just took a chair and then they took a chair and then put some handles on it. Yeah. And then instead of just handles, they put other straps and like, it was like, oh, I bet you that evolved through like time.
Imagine doing EMS in New York in a 6-floor walk up.
Hmm.
I mean, kill me now.
Yeah.
like I can't even imagine trying to do that with a stretcher or a backboard or any of those things. Cause some of those stairs are so narrow. The turns are so tight. Like now, that thing is awesome.
The thing that struck me about the stair chair though, was like, I could see why there are limited circumstances for it, because when you're sitting in a chair without some sort of side restraints or whatever, even though it has like an X harness on it, if that patient is gangly or excited or like, you know, resistant in any way, I could see that thing being super hard to handle in terms of like having a person like pushing weight in different ways or like sticking their arms out and getting caught on things, which is why I think one of the key points that they taught us was like, hey, when you strap them in, have them hold the handle, like hold the tails of the straps in their hands, give them something to do. Make sure their feet are not kicking it. Like you have to be secured. So like, I could just see, because that's an awkward, you're lifting somebody up high and they're upright.
Well, not just that, but that first kick out for the first set of stairs, if you're in that chair, is very disconcerting.
Yeah, I would say it's probably jarring or
100%
unnerving, at least.
So I say flex cuffs, but that's just me.
just throw them over their shoulder.
Throw some flex cuffs on them and you're good to go.
Yeah.
No, it's definitely a good piece of equipment. We use them all the time at work. It's definitely a back saver. And I mean, truly, I would imagine where you guys live that there are lots of places with stone steps out front or concrete steps out front. Everything's kind of built on a hillside. And the town I'm from, it is the city of the stair chair. If we go to a certain side of the town, we know we're going to be using the stair chair to get this person out of the house.
I grew up in Philly.
They're great.
I mean, Philly is nothing but old homes that have been chopped up into apartments. So
yeah.
I can only imagine how amazing that thing is when you can use it.
Yeah.
Do they have motorized stair chairs? Is that one of the things?
Yeah. They said there was something with a tri wheel that turns.
Yeah, I've seen those. I've seen images of those. I've never seen one in real life. I think they're prohibitively expensive.
I would imagine
it's like, if you're going to outfit, like, I would rather have a manual stair chair on all of the ambulances than have one of those automated things.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. And I assume it would probably, 9 times out of 10, if you're moving a patient, it's downstairs, I assume.
Yeah, they do, they don't really function all that well to get people upstairs, especially if somebody's like obese. It's a lot of weight. Now taking them downstairs, 100%.
Yeah,
but
I just imagine 90%. Like, I mean, if you're moving a patient out of a structure to an ambulance, I guess I'm thinking through most of the places I've been. Sometimes you'll have a downstairs or a ground, like a below ground or below grade apartment, but.
Right.
Or like in a facility that has like a basement level, but most residences, people usually hang out at like above the ground level.
Usually,
so I'd assume like most of it's going to be downhill, which
Plus,
is probably
like,
nice.
If you're going up, if you're going upstairs, you're not going to use that track, because that track's going to make it worse.
Yeah.
The track's going to provide resistance plus the weight of the patient.
Oftentimes, the solution to that is having more manpower.
Yeah, just throw people at it.
Yeah, I mean, you can use this. You can use the stair chair, but like again, you're just going to need more people on a regular basis. Myself and another person going downstairs can by ourselves handle that.
Yeah,
but for most instances. But if we're going to go up some stairs, I want as many people as I can get.
a lot of the, I had a question a couple of times during the class where I was like, say you need to move somebody and you don't have extra people. And like in my head, I'm always like thinking through like, but I have limited circumstances. I don't have more people to throw at the problem. They go, that's what you call the fire department for. And I go, oh yeah, I forget that like there's a big team behind the whole EMS side of things where you're like, I think at one point somebody was like, well, what if you do if the scene's unsafe? Like, you know, if somebody's looking like they're going to hurt somebody, or it's like,
call
the police and like, they take care of that and you come in later.
Yeah.
Like that's like, you all have to work together and have different roles.
Yeah.
You know, not to get too off topic, but it is a shift in mindset.
Yeah.
To have these other people that have different capabilities as far as like what their job or profession, you know, has them specialize in. So, but we do all have to work together. Yeah. And that's a great example of, hey, call the fire department and get some additional manpower.
I had a question for somebody and I'm like, well, if it was just you and a partner, like, could you recruit like other random people? Like, is there a legal reason why you wouldn't be able to just ask some bystanders like, hey, help me move this person, whatever, or like, you know, protocols or whatever? They go, well, I don't think there's any rule saying you can't, but that's why we have a fire department. Like, that's why we call them.
It was a key answer to the question.
I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Like, I just totally did not think that way.
Yeah.
But no, I think the stair chair is a cool tool of the trade. Yes. I think it's definitely one of those ones where like, you'll never experience it really outside of the EMS world. And it's a super like functional tool for that life. And, I think it's definitely a fun thing to play with, and I'm sure we'll get a bunch of experience on them. Okay. So we've gone through the gamut. We've talked through all the topics that we've gone through in our second class.
Yes.
Jonathan, any parting wisdom or tips for students?
So my EMT student tip of the week is going to be, we've been talking about moving patients and how difficult of a process that can be. One of the things that you as a student can do to set yourself up for success is to maintain a level of physical fitness. This is a demanding job. And not only does your community count on you to be able to answer the call when it happens, you are going to fare far better if you are physically fit and you have some sort of exercise routine that you're doing on a regular basis, maybe some strength training. You owe it to yourself, you owe it to your family, and you owe it to your community. So that is my EMT tip of the week. Make sure you maintain some sort of physical fitness as you go through the student process and afterwards.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so important. And it's just in life in general, like being a better person, being better prepared means, you know, getting better at the fitness stuff.
Yep.
Cool, man. Well, thank you so much for the, for the tip. I think that'll wrap us up for the week. Mm-hmm. But yeah, everybody check out the links down below in, you know, connect with us. Send us an email, come to the website, or not the website, the Facebook page. There'll be a website at some point, but come check us out. And thanks for taking the ride with us. We'll see you next time on The Ride Along. This podcast is for educational and storytelling purposes only. It is not medical advice or official EMT training. Always follow your accredited instructors and local protocols. Heartbeats racing in